Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 31. This week we'll discuss the Koch brothers, whose influence within the libertarian and Republican circles has made them arguably one of the most polarizing forces in American politics. Today I'm joined by Eric Taylor, Kirk Pettis, Lydia Tabbitt, and Danny Ning, and of course I am Matt Winter. We're going to open up today with a clip from our friend Eric Taylor.
Yeah, before I start, start off with a clip, I think we were talking about this before the show. A lot of us were saying there's not too much to add. But over the last probably 4 to 6 years, at least on the, within Republican circles, even, libertarian circles, there hasn't been a more active team than the Koch brothers. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars through various nonprofit organizations to impact the political sphere, really through the Republican Party. And this isn't, this isn't a new thing. I was doing research for the show and, found, the Koch brothers' father was Fred C. Koch, who started the company. He became very political after working with the USSR in expanding what then was primarily an oil company, and assisting the communist government in expanding and improving on their petro technologies. And from what I've seen and what I've read, he came really to an aha moment where it's like communism isn't good. It doesn't work well. He spent a lot of time in Russia, and he became really so affected by this that he, and this is largely known as a right wing fringe society, that he was one of the founding members of the John Birch Society, which is a anti-communist society that was started in the 50s and really was demonized specifically by the left for its anti-civil rights approach in the 60s. So he's kind of the patriarch of the family and affected Charles and David Koch quite a bit, and affected their libertarian ideology and their really pro-liberty, pro-freedom approach to both the company, which they inherited. It was worth a few hundred million dollars. Now it's worth, it's a private company, so you don't know the exact worth of the company, but it's upwards of $100 billion. And they used Austrian economic practices, libertarian philosophy, to grow the company into the second largest private company in the world. And they've been, very active in the political sphere, for almost 40 years. Working with a lot of, if you are in the liberty sphere, a lot of the more prominent libertarian organizations, Reason Magazine, the Cato Institute, they push a lot of money through Americans for Prosperity, which
Young Americans for Liberty,
right? Young Americans for Liberty. So, from a libertarian perspective, there is no stronger advocate for the basic principles of liberty than the Koch brothers, because they have the financial resources to push out the message, and they have the drive to do that. Now, where they come under a lot of heat is from the left, which, if you're doing any type of damage or you're successful, you should expect a lot of criticism. A lot of political criticism. They certainly have gotten that in spades over, especially over the last 4 to 6 years. So I thought it'd be good, a good topic to discuss, because there is, like you said, Matt, there is no probably more polarizing duo in politics right now than the Koch brothers. They're certainly, and they are libertarian, and they're trying to affect politics of the Republican realm. But they're like everyone, they have positives and negatives. So, I thought I would begin with a clip that kind of, in the liberty circles, you get infighting and factions and that type of thing. And there's a clip by Tom Woods who goes over kind of the involvement that the Koch brothers have had within liberty circles really over the last 40 years. So I'm going to play that, but I don't know if any of you guys have any thoughts on, you know, on their involvement in general, or if you'd like me just to roll the clip.
Let's roll a clip. Or at least I don't have anything to add right off the bat.
Okay. All right. And okay. This is 6.5 minutes, and I may, you know, if it makes sense to cut it short, I'll do so. Otherwise, I'll just roll it for the full 6.5 minutes.
Yep.
Now, this is maybe an unhappy subject, but I'd like to ask it anyway. To me, and there are some people who say that we worship Rothbard and all, you know, or Mises or whatever. And of course, the last thing Murray or any of the people we admire would have wanted is that we just take what they said as gospel and not investigate on our own or always be modifying where modifications are called for. But the point is, he was a great genius, and I think it would be crazy not to admire him, not to respect his work, to adopt the what Joe Salerno calls the Austro-punk position. But I guess I don't understand why it is that there is such sometimes stated, sometimes implicit hostility toward Rothbard in some sectors of the libertarian movement. We might call it the official libertarian movement, where there'll be think tanks that will 100 times mention Milton Friedman for every one time they mention Rothbard, but for every 0 times. I mean, Rothbard is like a non-entity, except perhaps for purposes of ridicule occasionally. What's the source of that? Where's that coming from? Isn't that deranged? Where's that coming from?
They do. They would say we're worshiping Rothbard, but they actually worship Friedman or somebody else.
Right.
So, yeah. It's a very interesting point. It all goes back to the whole struggle with the Koch brothers, the famous Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch. And when I first started the Mises Institute, I was friends with a man who was head of the Koch Foundation. I was very naive. And I wrote and I said, that I was going to start this institute and would appreciate their consideration for financial support. And I was given the extremely angry message back from the Koch folks that I was not to start the Mises Institute, that it would be extremely damaging, that they'd been working for many years to get rid of Mises, whom nobody liked. Even Milton Friedman didn't like him. And I said, hey, a medal on Mises' chest. So even Friedman didn't like him. He was a huge drag, and they wanted to make Hayek a key figure. And so to start a Mises Institute, not only would they not help, but they would actively oppose it. And indeed, that's, of course, has been the case all these years later. Charles and David are still very bitter. I don't know why. At one point, Charles was a Rothbardian, Charles Koch. I don't know what happened. I don't know why he has still to this day this burning hatred of Murray all these years after Murray's death. But it's true. And so the people you talk about are all either funded by Koch entities or would like to be funded by Koch entities. So really that's what it comes to. It comes to this, it's a decades-long hate campaign. It also goes back to Murray always said billionaires don't like to be told no. They're used to being told yes by everybody, and they get very upset when they're told no. And Murray had helped found the Cato Institute with Charles Koch and named it and was the chief intellectual guru. And then at one point, Charles decided that it was best for his, I guess, business interest or ideological interest or a combination of the two, that things change and that Austrian economics was really – aside of whether it was true or not, was a drag, maybe like Mises, that you couldn't get anywhere in Washington if you were promoting Austrian economics. It needed to be maybe a combination of the Chicago School and public choice. And so they wanted the first economist hired by the Cato Institute to be an economist of that sort. I'll say he's a great guy, nothing wrong with him, but Murray thought, well, gee, this was supposed to be about Austrian economics, this new institute. So when he opposed Charles's hiring this man, there was just a total blow up, and there were legal things, and they took Murray's stock in the institute and just set out to marginalize him and destroy him still to this day. So that's why it's politically incorrect for people who work for these think tanks to do anything but marginalize him. And we hear reports all the time about like the summer programs where they'll have denunciations of Rothbard.
It's crazy. I mean, it's like the opposite of – it's like a cult of anti-Rothbard, really.
Yeah. It's,
like you have to have the anti-Rothbard to be initiated into it.
No, and their academic programs seem to be about, you know, making sure that nobody likes Rothbard. You can be an anarchist. It's fine. But you can't be –
You can't be a Rothbardian type.
No, no. Yeah. That's still very, very politically incorrect.
Yeah. Which, and, of course, as you've told me before, the worst thing strategically you can do is tell young people, don't read this guy. What do you think they're going to go do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And what's the most popular libertarian T-shirt now? The Mises Institute's enemy of the state Rothbard silhouette shirt, right? I mean, everybody wants to wear that thing.
No, and, of course, Murray far better known, far more influential today because of the Internet than he ever was during his lifetime. So the attempt to marginalize him just hasn't worked. And, of course, he just still springs off the page at you. When you just open anything he's written, you just, holy smokes. And then you would just want to read more. So that's that power, his power, his intellectual power, his power as a writer. I've overcome all these lobbying efforts against him.
Now, I wasn't sure we were going to mention the Koch brothers, but as long as we have, where do you think the left is right about the Koch brothers and where are they wrong?
Well, of course, the left, you know, many times a bunch of jokers. So even, you know, they seem to accept the Koch's ideological rationale. It's like thinking you can interpret John D. Rockefeller by, you know, liberal Protestantism or George Soros by left liberalism. These are just covers for their for these oligarchs. No, and they all need ideological cover. So in the Koch's case, it's the free market. But the idea that these guys are actually promoting the free market or actually seeking to limit government, except in ways that might benefit their own companies, is just, of course, crazy. So the left is wrong to take them seriously ideologically. They are right that they are very, very powerful, that they are the key donors to the Republican Party, open and confidential. Ever since really the early 1990s, they're very, very powerful figures, and they're worth scrutiny. Whether they're getting themselves contracts in the Iraq War or whatever, these things are worth looking at. And just like George Soros is worth looking at, so are the Kochs. So the left, mostly gets it wrong, but not entirely wrong.
So that clip that's, some inside libertarian baseball, but it I thought gave a good overview of even the, it's almost like a populist versus corporate divide within the liberty movement where kind of the criticism of the Kochs in that clip was the fact that they aren't really benevolent. They're looking to reduce regulation and increase liberty for their own benefit, for their own corporate benefit. And that's, and I think I mentioned this before the show. I did a lot of searching. I tried to find, pro clips, and Lydia, you came up with one, which we'll listen to from Reason that goes over some of the better qualities of the Koch brothers. But there certainly seems to be criticism within the libertarian arena, as especially from the left. So that's kind of what that was going over. What do you guys think about that? Any thoughts?
Sorry, I was on mute there. I think one of the things I took from it right away was, is I don't know if it's so much an issue with them acting in self-interest. I think a lot of, not all, and I think whoever was speaking in the clip is right on the money with saying they qualify for any sort of scrutiny, just as any other, large influential political influence or political kind of powerhouse, I think, rightly should be scrutinized. But I think the issue that I took from that more is that is a frustration with sort of a centralized or organizing sort of control of the liberty movement in general. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Sort of a dismissal of other ideas or I don't know, censorship almost.
But why would they be doing that? What, you know, why would they try to censor other type of political movements? And, I mean, the reason behind it is, I think, is because, you know, they want to push their agendas. And it's like almost like, you know, you hear about like the New World Order of society. It's like they're almost trying to push their own New World Order society of their own agenda. Yeah, they say, like, you know, we're limited government and all that, but, you know, only up to, you know, what we believe in. Everything else is false, but, you know, it's like, you know, it's like you play, it's like they're trying to play this as like their own type of game. So I don't know, that's just kind of what I thought about, you know, about what they're trying to do is just to try, I don't know, maybe they're trying to make Coke Industries as the most powerful industries in the world. Who knows? Try to top Cargill and try to control the world. I'm not sure. Maybe that's kind of conspiracy, but I don't know. Kirk, you can talk a little bit more about that because, you know, you'll like a little bit more conspiracies than most of us. But but that's kind of what I'm thinking is, you know, they're trying to push their agendas. They're trying to potentially – I can't speak what they're thinking. I mean, obviously, these guys are billionaires. They're smart people. They're – probably know what they're doing more than what I'm doing, but it just seems like they're trying to push their agenda down our throats and, you know, playing this as a game. So,
well, here's a question for you: is acting in your own self interest a bad thing necessarily?
Nope.
No,
but I feel like, you know, they're because these guys are just, you know, they already have more than what they needed. But it just seems like they want more, you know, like just back in that clip saying, you know, the guy said that, you know, these guys are billionaires. They don't like other people telling them.
Hang on a second, Danny. It's not that they have enough already. They're an organization. Their net worth, they don't have a $40 billion liquid cash reserve in their names or in any holding anywhere. They're an industry, and their industry relies on them. They're the ownership of their companies. So every employee relies on them to continue the business, and a business is not going to succeed if it stops being profitable. So it's someone's net worth is always going to increase no matter what if you're continuing to prosper through life. So it's and when you have that much influence and that much control in an economy, you need to I don't fault anyone at all to go out there and try and procure their own success when there's such a stigma in society of someone making money like that or holding a private company that is private. In every clip we saw, in every bit of research I went through, it's they lambast the Coke industry for being a private corporation or a private enterprise, and to where you don't know, you can't go dive down and see what they expend on everything, and I don't know. There's just a whole different process between a private and a public corporation, and it's and they're lambasted for it. Right or wrong, I don't see it. I'll get to this point later, but I would never fault anyone for being as rich as they want to be. I mean, it's not if they quit doing what they are doing, it will send more shockwaves through the economy by them just quitting what they're doing. Versus I fault them for limiting competition against them. There's no doubt about that. I think that they end up utilizing government to hamper competition, just like that clip earlier, how someone else wanted to go start their own organization. They're like, we're starting our own, so you better not. We're going to go after you if you do.
And right, so and that's basically my argument. You know, it's fine that, you know, these guys are, you know, obviously, like I stated before, they're very smart individuals. They know how to run businesses. They know how to, like, acquire the businesses to, you know, to prosper the Coke industries. And, you know, that's fine. You know, that's just business as usual. But, you know, when you're trying to get politics involved into it to influence that, to kind of to make it, you know, to change the game where, you know, they become eventually like a monopoly of everything, you know, that's kind of, you know, I just don't like that. That's kind of like against the free markets, you know, ideology, kind of like what you're saying. So that's what I'm against with
Ryan.
What the Cokes are doing.
Yeah, I well, totally understand.
I don't actually agree with that. I think it is very much a free market thing that they're taking advantage of. I don't know that it's anti-competitive, but they're operating
like
within free market constraints. Yeah, I mean, the way it is right now, that's part of the free market.
Well, I don't see it as controlling the government. I see it as promoting an ideology. And I think it's spun to argue that their money that they influence, that they put into politics, is supposedly buying people or controlling the Republican Party, per se, but I don't see them having more control than anything else. I mean, they're not very Republican. When you look at the Republican platform, they're against half the platform. So the Republican Party hasn't ditched that other half, and the half that the Koch industry, Koch brothers foster, is the half that I'd like to prefer to see the Republican Party be as. So it's hard for me to argue against them for what they're doing, but at the same time, I don't think it's the best means, and I think and they have their own interests, and yeah, I don't agree with a lot of interests. So it's, you know, who am I? There's not much I can do about it, and that's just, yeah, how it is.
All right, so go ahead.
I was going to say, you have to ask yourself, at what point does a corporation become large enough that it needs to be dismantled and turned into other corporations? And the reason I ask that question is simply because corporation used to be a public trust prior to the Freedom of Slaves Act. Was that the 14th Amendment? I think it was the 14th Amendment. But the prior to that,
yeah, actually, we were just talking about this at the thing I went to a couple weeks ago at the Chan Library. Sorry, continue. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. So prior to the 14th Amendment, corporations were considered part of a public trust where they had a spelled out, defined, this is their purpose and this is their what they were supposed to do. Now, in that was also they're supposed to turn a profit. That was part of the deal. But some very clever lawyers, post-14th Amendment, went and got it legally changed so that all businesses are now people. And since they're people, they have to have their own agendas. And the agenda that corporations have legally that they're required to have is to turn a profit. So they actually lose their ethical need at that point. They no longer – ethically, they have to turn a profit. And whatever they have to do to turn that profit, they can do. So in the idea that Monsanto is – caused all kinds of problems, and other corporations caused all kinds of problems in seeking profit. They've caused damage, and so you have to say, at what point do they need to be dismantled when they're buying all these other companies? And you know, I guess that's a conversation for another day. But at the same time, working within the constraints of what we have available today, I think that the Koch brothers are doing exactly what they should be doing as far as running their business and influencing politics in that regard.
Well, the reason that this came to be about is because our government has forced the United States is a corporation, and they've forced us all to be corporations. So we're all corporations now. The government has to deal corporation to corporation. So everything's a corporation now. So of course a corporation's viewed as a person, because I can't think of the right word, but since American citizens still think they're a person, not a corporation, in legalese terms, since American citizens think they're not a corporation and they view themselves as persons, when So, but then for the government to go and say, oh, yeah, corporations are actually persons, is because persons are corporations. So it's such a muddled thing. They have to do it that way for in legalese terms. But, and that all happened because of in the last 100 years. So post 14th Amendment, like you're saying, Matt. But there it goes. Some might say it's conspiracy. Others.
Can I get a lone wolf? Can I get a lone wolf?
I will prove it someday.
You will. I hope you do. I hope you do, Kirk.
So, kind of the thing that I've thought about in regard, you know, to the Koch brothers. You know, they're obviously acting in self-interest. So self-interest for them, you know, and everyone's influenced in different ways. Self-interest from them from a commercial or corporate perspective is to have as little regulation as possible. They're a conglomerate. Their business is a conglomerate. So they're in, you know, a bunch of different areas. You know, one of the more financially lucrative areas that they're involved in is in oil. They own a lot of tar sand property in Canada. They have a vested interest in the Keystone Pipeline. If that actually does come to pass, from what I've read, they stand to gain upwards of $100 billion in profit from the extraction of resources in the Alberta-Canadian tar sands. To the transport via the Keystone Pipeline. So they certainly have a vested interest in getting Keystone passed, and they have a vested interest in they'll probably, I would argue, as little EPA regulation as humanly possible on their petrol and carbon extraction resources. So they... you know, are involved in freedom or liberty and all that stuff. But is there, and, you know, I certainly think the more of that, the better. But is there cause for concern over an outfit that maybe wants to have, you know, wields their financial might to, you know, arguably pick politicians, buy off politicians, you know, have a political environment that allows them to maximize their profits? I mean, is that libertarian, or is it just using a political philosophy or ideology as really a cover over maximizing profits?
It's tough to nail down, but go ahead, Lydia.
Oh, okay. So I guess my perspective when it comes to the Koch brothers is, I believe in individual rights, property rights, et cetera. And so really, for me at least, I am less concerned about what the Koch brothers' motivations are, unless it is in some way to me revealed that they are in some way conflicting with my own personal morals or values. And so my perspective, or my opinion, at least when it comes to the Koch brothers, is, you know, if they're willing to fundraise or to provide, financial support to organizations that I personally, view as being worthwhile or doing, valuable work, then I have no problem with it. But I mean, I do believe in property rights and the like, and but at the same time, I also believe in education and a little bit of sort of critical thinking. So I think for me, it's a healthy balance of, you know, it's their own money, it's whatever their own ambitions or interests are, which is to me is fine, as they're not. So long as they're not, I don't know,
infringing your civil liberties.
Yeah, as long as they're not promoting issues or content which I personally don't support. I just am pretty confident in my own views and my own opinions on things that to me it's a lot about like kind of critical thinking. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So,
well, let's go back to the environmental impacts. Since when do the regulations promote and produce a better, do they really promote a better environment around us? Is it the regulations that do so? I mean, I think if it was framed in harming the environment harms other people's, if you do it personally, can inadvertently end up harming other person's property.
Oh, absolutely.
So that goes back into dealing with, so you deal it accordingly. And all the negativity is, you know, portrayed in all these articles that in the research I was doing, and it talks about this oil spill or this and that, but it doesn't put it in any context of similarities to other things. It's just labeled as such, and oh, it's so bad, and so everyone just assumes the worst, that they're out there just reaping profits over shoddy working, you know, shoddy repairs and disregard to the environment. And so would regulations actually fix that, or would an adherence to more libertarianism ideology or that they promote of private property and less government? So when the Koch brothers argue for less government intrusion, do you think they're actually arguing that they should get away with whatever the mishaps that they do? I don't believe that's true.
And well, I think what the argument is that there shouldn't be a centralized or monopolized force on that kind of a thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, if they are, to me, my opinion is that is mostly based on property rights, I guess. And sorry, I just completely lost my train of thought there.
I think it's important to state what the libertarian philosophy is. So the libertarian philosophy says an individual corporation causes some kind of damage to the environment, to people's property or something along those lines. They have a direct responsibility for restitution to the people who are harmed by that, which means monetarily they're responsible for paying for those damages. And that's different than having regulators come in and say, you have to comply with these regulations. Now, today, I think we can all agree that that is not happening, and that it's actually probably less expensive for these corporations to have the regulators come in and interfere with the way they do business than it is to have them pay those restitutions in many cases, because you look at now, this is my opinion here. No longer stating what the libertarian fact is, but you look at the past prosecutions that have happened against different corporations like Monsanto when they were purchasing two-headed cows and stuff down in Texas, and then they ended up settling out of court based on some monetary values that they felt was okay, when there were entire cities where the oldest people are living to is in their mid-30s, and those types of things were happening for many years, and those corporations knew these problems were happening, and they continued to do what was causing the problems because it was cheaper to continue making the profit and polluting and then pay out a court than it was for them to correct what they were doing and causing damage to the environment. So right. I personally look at the perspective of the regulation in the way laws are written today as being necessary. If you could rewrite the laws to where corporations had to pay for the wrongdoings that they did to people, then it would create an incentive for those corporations to not cause those problems in the first place. Free market, capitalism, this is a real solution to the problem instead of the weird like pseudo free market thing we have going on right now that they talk to the attorneys and the attorneys say we can get away with it and we'll only have to pay this much, which means we'll make more profit this year.
Yeah, and it's how positive law works, it's how regulations work, to where guild if every company had to follow the exact same rules, live under the exact same boats, every cost through regulation and laws is always only transferred to the customer. So, or the consumer, the customer, or whatnot. But when there's all these other laws and regulations that stipulate it's okay here, it's wrong there, it's, you know, it's such a convoluted mess of how our code system works today that getting away with not following a code can be profitable because everyone else is doing it at the same time. But if you get rid of all that, I mean, I look back at the framing of our country, there wasn't a concept really of environmental degradation or environmental impact. And I personally believe my viewpoint would be as a better form of governance or and way to run business is to have the most sustainable self-contained industry that you can that everything needs to be contained and remediated at in-house to where pretty much any pollutant can be remedied. Is so if you got rid of all the taxes and you just had a national sales tax or usage tax, then all these costs is just the cost of doing business. And so then every business has to self-contain all their pollution. And so there'd be self-regulated through that. And that would be lead to innovation of better methods of reducing pollution that would lead to a cheaper product in the long run, because all those costs are in-house that get directly transferred to the consumer. Do you see what I'm saying? Versus from an outside entity of government that comes in and says, oh, you're doing it wrong if they catch you. And then it's all through a legal battle. And then they fine them and if the wrongdoing's done. And then what does the government end up doing with all that money usually? It ends up going into the coffers and hardly going to remediate the situation in the first place. So to me, it's a convoluted system. It's a broken system, and I believe if this environmentalist mentality was back then, I think it would have been structured a little more succinctly in the Constitution and dealt with in a far different, better, more efficient manner than it is today.
Yeah, it's tough to account for technology a couple hundred years in advance.
Yeah, it's just any pollution is really harming the environment around you and harming other's property. So all pollution should be as best self-sustained and self-controlled. And I believe that should be directly to the cost of doing the business and the cost of production. And so the costs are directly associated with using that product instead of bringing it out into the government sphere and in a community, communal manner and, I don't know, further government control. You have politicians, you buy off. If you get this politician in, all right, I'm going to make more money this way. And it's such a mess. It just sheds light on the fallacy of the system we live under today.
So we're ready for another clip. I think probably Kirk, you probably heard of this guy, Thom Hartmann. Have you heard of him before?
Heard of him, yes.
He's not real well-liked from our side of things, but this is a longer one. We can cut it short. But he basically – I mean, this is really – and there are some good points, but this is a very anti-Koch Brothers clip, which they all are, with the exception of one. That kind of – he touches on some of the environmental things and some of the ethic issues that may surround the Koch brothers. So I'll go ahead and roll this clip.
To understand the present, you have to understand the past, which brings us to this fascinating story of a guy named William A. Clark. Now, for our listeners in Montana, you know who I'm talking about. Clark was one of the copper kings of the late 1800s in Montana. He made millions in the booming mining industry. He tried his hand at the electric industry, this brand new thing that Thomas Edison started, the newspaper industry. He owned banks. He owned railroad lines. He was involved in a lot of business. He got really, really rich. And then he decided, hey, let's run for political office. Be a big shot. I want to be the senator. He had this lifelong ambition of becoming an elected official and of getting the fame and power that came with it. So in 1899, the election of 1900, right? In the election of 1900, he wanted to be a U.S. senator. Now, back then, U.S. senators were not elected by we the people. That was an amendment to the Constitution in the 19-teens, the 17th Amendment. Back then, U.S. senators were chosen by their respective state legislators. So one afternoon, Clark walked into the Montana State Legislature and announced that he would be standing in the back of the room holding envelopes filled with $1,000 bills. And he said he'd give those envelopes to anyone who voted for him to be their senator, to represent them in Washington, D.C. And enough legislators voted for him and took his money that Montana sent him to Washington, D.C. as their senator for the 1900 legislative session. But William Clark's bribery scheme, this was so public. I mean, he was just right up front about it. He stood back there waving the envelopes. The newspaper reporters got it. It was so brazen that even the largely corrupt U.S. Senate was horrified, and they refused to seat him after reading newspaper stories about his passing out these $1,000 bills to get elected. In fact, it was the notoriety of Clark's naked bribery attempt in Montana, which was well-reported in newspapers across the country, that helped lead to the passage of the 17th Amendment, which said that we the people get to elect the senators instead of bought-off state legislators. So with all this notoriety, Clark pretty much became public enemy number one in the early 1900s. Mark Twain, yes, Sam Clemens, good old Mark Twain, wrote about Clark, quote, "He is as rotten a human being as can be found anywhere under the flag. He is a shame to the American nation, and no one who has helped to send him to the Senate who did not know that his proper place was in the penitentiary with a chain and a ball on his legs." Now, he died in 1925, but his willingness to corrupt the American democratic and political process is alive and well today. I mean, seriously, just look at the Koch brothers. David and Charles Koch are worth an estimated $68 billion. And they're among the driving forces behind the corruption of our democracy. Between 1998 and 2008, Koch brother-controlled foundations, they're not passing out $1,000 bills in the back of the room. They gave more than $196 million to organizations which favor policies that would pad the wallets of these two brothers. In that same time period, Koch Industries, owned by the two brothers, spent $50 million on lobbying and handed out $8 million in PAC contributions. Kochs are also behind groups like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works, which both gave and continue to give major financial support to the Kochhead Tea Party movement. And Freedom Partners, a Koch-affiliated organization, has doled out grants worth over $230 million to a variety of conservative organizations, Tea Party groups, and front groups that oppose Obamacare. Which brings us to the Keystone XL pipeline. This is incredible. Recently, the Koch brothers have been throwing their billions at lobbyists, front groups, and lawmakers who support the fossil fuel industry and the construction of the Keystone pipeline. They are the fossil fuel industry's largest donors to congressmen and women who sit on the committee that oversees the Keystone XL pipeline. In 2010 alone, the Kochs and their employees gave over $300,000 to members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. This is the committee that oversees the Keystone pipeline. At the same time, Kochs have given more than $60 million over the last 15 years to groups that deny climate change. So why are they doing this? Why are they handing out money to people who support Keystone XL pipeline and support America's toxic addiction to fossil fuels? Simple answer. It's going to blow your mind. Money. According, and lots of it. According to a new report
by
the International Forum on Globalization, the Koch brothers stand to make up to $100 billion in profits if the Keystone XL pipeline is approved. Keep in mind, these two guys are only worth $68 billion. This could double their net worth. The report found that the Kochs and Koch Industries hold up to 2 million acres of land in Alberta, Canada, which is the proposed starting point of the Keystone XL pipeline. And many Koch industry subsidiaries are going to make millions on the pipeline's construction, including Koch Exploration Canada, which is going to profit from oil exploration on its land, Koch Supply and Trading, which would benefit from the trading of oil derivatives. I mean, they're looking at a $100 billion windfall down the road. That's more than double their combined fortune today. So, surprise, they're doing everything they can to make the Keystone XL pipeline a reality. I mean, look at back just last week. The Republicans in Congress tried to use the Keystone XL pipeline as leverage in the government shutdown, demanding that it be approved. Yeah, you got to approve this or we're not going to raise the debt ceiling. Right. Meanwhile, you and I are stuck with the byproducts of the Koch's relentless pursuit of money and power. Koch Industries is already one of the top 10 polluters in the United States, pumping millions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere each year, driving global warming and climate change. And if the Keystone XL pipeline is finished, it'll make things even worse. Synthetic crude oil from tar sands generates three times the pollution of regular crude oil and is very poisonous. I mean, just small leaks in this pipeline could be catastrophic. So today, the ghost of William A. Clark is alive and well in the form of billionaires like the Koch brothers who are corrupting our political process.
Very poisonous.
Well, how it just shows what's wrong with the government today. It's why should people be able to get politicians in that enrich themselves? To me, it's just how can we live in a free, a so-called free society, yet our government can enact legislation that enriches certain individuals? How is that a free society?
Be more of a, what would be the definition? Probably fascist society?
It's pretty close, yes. So to me, all this negativity and whatnot just makes me so irritated to hear all these emotional talk on all these journalists talk and rail against the Koch brothers when it's the whole system that is at fault. But they can't argue that because they are promoting the system on the other side. And they believe that the government needs to be there and control all this stuff and be in everyone's hands about and regulate everyone's manners in life. And it's so unfree and just society that I don't know how they can argue that when you can point your finger at any of these major corporations. They said that it was in the top 10 of polluters in the United States when they are the second largest private enterprise. So they're not even in the top 10 biggest companies probably, but I don't know. I wonder where Cargill stands as a polluting entity. But and I'm as a civil engineer, I'm very anti-pollution. I think and there's better ways to deal with it than to just sit there and regulate it and say this is all right, this much is all right here, but you know, over here that's wrong. But like I was saying before, I think everything should be self-contained and dealt with there, and the costs are directly associated into that individual product. But and then it leads to a more sustainable culture, because if people don't want it, you know, because the costs are too high, then you don't get that product. You don't siphon off the harmful byproducts of it to this
adios
that affects the country and the society around us and push it off into other spheres of the globe. But anyways.
Yeah, there is kind of a duality when you talk specifically about the Koch brothers. They have self-interest in mind, but yet they align pretty closely with most people's philosophy who are involved in the liberty movement. So they're really, you know, they're out there pushing that message forward. That's what I observed. And there's, like I said, when we started, there's positives and negatives, and they're going to do what's best for themselves. And you know, to me, it just so happens to align with, you know, personally with my views politically, and probably, you know, with everyone on the podcast. But I don't know. I haven't come to a, you know, any conclusion one way or another, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, I don't see the influence that they have. I don't, the people on the street aren't learning about liberty ideals from the Koch brothers, in my opinion. And I don't think it comes from their organizations that they fund mostly either. But I think once people start getting interested in it and start doing more research, then they come across these influences that these institutions promote. Mm-hmm. But the general influence that they have is either very well hidden then, or it's strictly through, you know, promoting and stopping regulation through the government sphere. And to me, that's where most of it is. And I don't think the American public really see any of that influence being publicized. They just hear the amount of money that it does and what, you know, it's being thrown in there. But I don't think anyone really understands where that money goes through Washington and how that money is utilized. So it's all conjecture, emotion that it just brings up in people.
All right. And they, you know, they have a pretty, I'm sure probably everyone has, have you guys seen like a flow chart of how their money operates through various organizations?
No, but all I know is our government sits there and takes our money and goes and funnels it into their own self-interest. So I am all for private people out there pumping money in against it. I mean, the amount of money our government spends on shit that we don't need or want to promote their own agenda, to buy off scientists, journalists, and promote and the public indoctrination of society is so vast that anyone that wants to counter that, and that's all I knew about the Koch brothers before, you know, did any research into them. I was always all for them. Fine, great. Someone's actually trying to fight what the government's doing. Great, you know. And then when you go down there, you see, you know, how the Koch brothers have managed their businesses through time, and yeah, there's a lot of negatives. But someone has to fight the direction the government's heading. And the more money someone has to be able to throw at it, all the better. I just wish it was better utilized. But
with that, why don't I play? This is a longer clip, but this is a pro, and this is a pro Coke clip, and kind of illustrates, you know, some positive things that they have done, they're looking to do.
I don't know that it's a pro Koch brothers clip, but to me, it's at least a little bit more of a fair representation than what you would see
at least
from
a little,
an opposing agenda.
It's a little more actual journalism,
in my opinion. Yes.
Great.
Yeah. All right. So we'll go ahead and roll it.
Helping to mainstream libertarian ideas, I think that's Charles Koch's legacy.
All Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Daniel Shulman. He's a senior editor at Mother Jones, and he's the author of the explosive, provocative, and absolutely must-read book, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. Dan, thanks for talking
to
us. You know, the big reveal in your book, or one of many, and this is, I mean, you look at the Koch brothers or Koch Industries kind of rise to, you know, superpower within within oil and gas and a variety of other industries, as well as their political influence. But a big thing is that David and Charles Koch, and I'll point out in terms of full disclosure, David Koch sits on the board of Reason Foundation that publishes Reason TV. But you point out that they are libertarian, not conservative. Explain a little bit about what that means and how, you know, how did that hit you when you started digging into that?
Well, I think that's sort of an interesting distinction, but because currently they really have a reputation as Republican power brokers or kingmakers. But, you know, part of this book was really looking at the roots of their political thinking and ideology. And when you trace those back, you see that, you know, Charles Koch was, you know, highly involved with the fledgling libertarian movement of the early 1960s and 70s, you know, at a time when the movement could basically fit within Murray Rothbard's, you know, apartment. And what's interesting is that these guys are considered conservatives, but they're really not social conservatives in any sense of the word.
Well, talk a little bit about what are your sources for that, or how would you describe them?
I think some of their own statements. You know, Charles Koch has written about this stuff going back to the 70s, including in Libertarian Review, the magazine he owned in the late 70s up until I think maybe 1981 or something like that. There was an issue on libertarian strategy where he wrote a really fascinating essay in which he is sort of railing against the businessmen of his time for hypocrisy, essentially.
And that's because they would look for, you know, they would say, oh, well, we're in favor of free enterprise, but they don't want to extend that to social arenas.
Exactly. They would rail against welfare for the poor, but at the same time, they would be seeking corporate welfare. Mm-hmm. They would be partnering with government in order to create regulations that would keep other companies out.
Well, you know, in the book, I mean, you point out that these guys, you know, David and Charles Koch are the principals at Koch Industries. They are against all forms of subsidy.
It's right.
They're really not, you know, they're not saying, oh, except for my business. How does that change the calculus of, you know, how you think they should be perceived by, you know, the left, by the right, by Americans in general?
Well, I think the one misconception that people have about these guys is that they are merely out there to line their pockets. And I think if you look at their beliefs in sort of a consistent framework, you have to start to see these guys outside the political villain, robber baron caricature.
Right. I mean, just, you know, I agree with virtually all of what they talk about. There's obviously disagreements, but that this is, they're not opportunistic in any way, shape, or form.
No, yeah. But the one thing that I have an op-ed in the Washington Post this weekend, which kind of discusses some of the areas where there are misconceptions about their politics, including on social issues. Obviously, they're anti-war, they're pro-civil liberties. But then again, you don't really see them putting their money where their mouths are so much on these issues.
Right.
And I kind of wondered if they were to do so, if that would, A, change their political image, and B, if that would influence the Republican Party in certain
ways.
Well,
and this is interesting because in the book, you know, again, the Kochs, you know, when they're invoked as this kind of grand abstraction, you know, the Rasputins of the right or whatever, you actually quote a number of Koch people in the book who say, hey, you know what, the GOP doesn't trust us. They're uncomfortable with us. You know, is that because they are actually consistent in saying we want small government and we don't want government picking winners and losers and the social issues?
In the narrow subset of issues in which the Republicans and the Koch brothers agree, I mean, we're largely talking about economic ones.
Right.
An interesting episode was that the Koch's political advisors sort of cringed at was David Koch at the Republican National Convention in Tampa in 2012. Tells a reporter that he's pro-gay marriage. And this is sort of highlighted. This is at the time when the Republicans were enshrining a plank in their platform calling for a federal constitutional right. ban on gay marriage. So this was sort of highlighting one of the areas where they're out of sync with the Republican Party, and I think the Kochs people were trying to keep things sort of simpatico.
Here's a question. I mean, you write for a lefty progressive magazine, Mother Jones. How do you think if the Kochs came out and said, yeah, you know what, on social issues, we don't think the government should be involved, would that work, would that help them with the left, or would that not be meaningful?
I do think, I mean, at this point, it's hard to say because they've become such political caricatures. People on the left, you know, sometimes instinctually hate them. In fact, right. I had people, after my book came out, sort of lambasting me for treating them as, quote, too human. Mm-hmm. So it's unclear if things have kind of gotten too far for people on the left to actually see that there's places of mutual agreement with the Kochs.
How, here's a question. One of the things that the Koch brothers have been doing, or Charles Koch in particular, has been hosting seminars where he brings in wealthy people and they create, you know, and they raise money to push GOP candidates or GOP issues. And I guess it's not specifically GOP, it's that that tends to be the party that has candidates that people want to do. How effective do you think have they been in these efforts to kind of push a GOP ascendancy?
I think in 2012, the results were essentially a colossal failure. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be painfully aware of mm-hmm. this.
And by they, you're...
The Kochs and their political operation. They had a lot of high-profile donors, including Foster Friis, who I should add is a social conservative,
right.
so isn't completely in alignment
right.
with Charles and David Koch, who were quite turned off by both sort of accountability issues about mm-hmm. how the money was spent, and also about, of course, the outcome.
Right.
The one thing that's interesting...
Because, going into the election, I mean, all the signs pointed to an incredibly vulnerable Obama
yep.
presidency. I mean, he's running for a second term with terrible approval ratings, terrible economy, you know, botched up foreign policy. And yet the Republicans couldn't deliver a winning candidate.
Right. And the interesting thing is if you talk to people on the conservative side about the Koch's political effort, the one thing they'll point out is that while within Koch Industries they have this rigid market-based management mm-hmm. system where they relentlessly measure anything, mm-hmm. they didn't really see that same thing taking place within the political operation. The one thing the Koch brothers do is that they really learn from their mistakes. So what you see right now is kind of the overhaul of their political operation. I think 2014 is going to be when it's a make or break sort of situation. I think you'll see huge changes happen if the Republicans don't take back the Senate, for instance. Mm-hmm.
What about in libertarian ideas? How would you say, you know, and we're looking at something that's basically 50 years now. Charles Koch has been affiliated with a lot of groups, including the Institute for Humane Studies, which started in the early 60s. That kind of push libertarian ideas and try and create a libertarian infrastructure. How would you measure their success in that effort?
I think they've been remarkably successful in that. In helping to mainstream libertarian ideas, I think that's Charles Koch's legacy. He spent more than 50 years basically trying to create and help to fund the intellectual infrastructure for this, whether it's Institute for Humane Studies, something like the Mercatus Center, or just one of the hundreds of universities and academics that he has funded. I think he's been hugely influential.
Is that, this is something which it seems like on either side of, you know, or any point on the political spectrum, people will say, oh, well, that's bad, you know, because if you fund somebody like, you know, Friedrich Hayek or publishing Friedrich Hayek, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, work, you know, then you're buying his brain power. Somebody like Randy Barnett, the Georgetown Law professor, who's a titan of libertarian thought, who's gotten funding from a wide variety of people. Is that just cant? You know, when, you know, people on the right hate it when George Soros does it, and people on the, I mean, do we have to get past that?
I think so. I mean, because obviously, you know, it helped, but with literature, that's what, mm-hmm. that's what you studied, right?
Right.
So I personally don't see any problem with the Kochs using, and Charles Koch using his money to fund academic institutions. I know that there's been quite a bit of controversy about this at places like Florida State, and elsewhere. But that to me is like there's a separate issue. There was an issue about how the level of control that they were seeking over this money, and the sort of vetting of professors and things like that. But in terms of just funding fellowships and that sort of thing, I mean, it's given a lot of people opportunities in higher education.
Do you think that we're entering a phase now where, you know, there seems to be a kind of revitalized progressive left, not, you know, not liberals, but, you know, further out on the left and kind of punchier and more pugilistic, I guess, you know, and forward looking, as well as on the right? I mean, it seems like on the broadly construed right, all of the energy is coming from libertarian people. It's not coming from, you know, the Mike Huckabees of the world or the Rick Santorums. Do you think this, you know, the stage is being set for the next kind of battle of ideas between the libertarian right and the progressive left? And if so, you know, can you handicap that?
I mean, that's a very interesting question. And I think you could start to see that happening. Absolutely. In the U.S. Congress, you see the rise of folks like Rand Paul, who obviously very staunchly libertarian guy, though he's, you know, under the Republican Party banner. I'm not sure if I could handicap how things are going to shake out in this war.
Well, who wins if the future is a fight between, say, Elizabeth Warren and Rand Paul? Who are you rooting for, and who do you think will win?
Oh, goodness.
Which are separate questions.
Wow. Elizabeth Warren, hugely popular on the left right now. Great sort of populist figure. Rand Paul, another guy who's been energizing the right over a sort of a range of issues, and also has gotten kudos from folks on the left for his stands against kind of drones and his pro-civil liberties, kind of NSA reform. I'm not sure I can say who wins it.
It'll be a better world, I hope, if that's who's making the arguments. Final question. How did you, and I read in an interesting kind of online chat you did with Gawker, you said that the thing that you look for most in a book topic was, are people interesting?
I think we can cut that.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, one of the interesting points, and I think that this could manifest itself tomorrow, is the fact that, you know, one thing that Nick Gillespie mentioned is that the Kochs have a tendency to learn from their mistakes. They spent a lot of money in the 2012 election cycle and didn't do very well. And they've certainly been spending a substantial amount of money this cycle. And it looks like it looks like the Senate will be Republican this time around. They'll probably have a 4-6 seat majority in the Senate. And they have been focusing on state House races as well, and seem to have done a better job from what I've observed this time around than what they did in 2012. So they, you know, they've got that going for them.
Yeah, we'll have to see tomorrow then.
I have a prediction.
Yes.
It's very negative.
Okay.
My prediction is my prediction is, well, we stand at a precipice where a simple catalyst can flocculate and gum up the entire works of an economy right now. Yeah. And I don't think if it's done on purpose, there has to be a Republican majority in both houses.
What do you mean?
Because then you blame it on the free market and capitalism.
Yeah.
And people like the Koch brothers that funded it. And it's setting the stage for when the dollar's demise and the growth of a global governance to stop people like the Koch brothers and a free market libertarian ideals. And I just I'm worried about that the Republicans win, actually, and that nothing, it's only going to end up being worse in the long run because of it. But that's my prediction. In the next 2 years, that if the Republicans take both houses, which it looks like it they will, that it could ease this catalyst, could easily just appear out of nowhere and create a big havoc. And that is the true lone wolf call of the day.
This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 31. It's been Eric Taylor, Kirk Pettis, Lydia Tabbitt, Danny Ning, and myself, Matt Winter. Have a great night.
Adios.
Matt, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, we're not quite done yet, as I had a audio drop.
Gonna do it again?
We can, but we can. I assume you started because you just didn't hear anything.
I didn't hear anything.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something, Eric?
I was talking, but issues.
We'll repeat it.
All right. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, I was just looking for some. So we had Kirk's thought. Danny, Lydia, Matt, did you guys have any other thoughts on kind of just an overview of the conversation or how this will impact? Going forward?
No, not really.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess for myself, I'm just a big believer in education, critical thinking, and personal responsibility. And I think those are how you make the best decisions for yourself and for the things that you value or you believe in. And so I think for me, those are sort of my guiding principles and critical thinking are sort of what guide me in navigating what I think is honest political support, financial or otherwise, or corrupt influence of the process. So to me, it comes down to personal responsibility and just sort of education, critical thinking, when it comes to Koch brothers or other major influencers of political or philosophical thought. So,
yeah, I'd agree with that. And you have to kind of, from it would be nice if most people kind of, because they're always, you know, when anyone is involved with anything, that there are individual concerns and then more benevolent, altruistic concerns about society. So you have to kind of weigh the two, with the Koch brothers or with any other group. And, you know, they're doing things out of self-interest and then out of helping society. So you have to kind of weigh it, and it's always kind of a delicate balance.
Good for them.
Yep. So with that, go ahead, Matt.
This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 31. Eric Taylor, Kirk Pettis, Lydia Tabbitt, Danny Ning. Have a good night.
Adios.
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 Mofo.
Mofo.